Hi, I'm Shane Bishop, Senior Pastor of Christ Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Welcome to week 3 of the Be a Game Changer series. Today we look at Mordecai. I'm ready to go. Let's get at it. I am so excited about the Game Changer series. My small group has been meeting. We've had some great discussions. I hope that your groups are having great discussions as well. We are in week 3. We have launched this thing. I can't wait to see how God is going to impact your life and the life of our church through Be a Game Changer. Let's begin with 7 things game changers understand. These are our organizing thoughts for the series. Number 1, the game needs changed. Number 2, change begins with us. Number 3, things don't change on their own. Number 4, new outcomes require new inputs. Number 5, we must be willing to be changed. Number 6, we must allow God to change us. And number 7, change does not come easy. So what I need you to hear is that if you are going to be a game changer in your own life or in your own context, it's an uphill climb. Change does not come easy. In a fallen world, everything conspires to take us the wrong direction. You want to go the right direction, you're going to need a catalyst. You're going to need someone to be a game changer. In week 1, we looked at the elite soldier Ehud, who led from the top. He was an ambassador. He was a diplomat. He had a special set of skills. He led from the top. He picked a fight only God could finish. He mobilized the army. He won peace for Israel for 80 years. Ehud was the arrow and not the target. Last week we looked at Jochebed, a disenfranchised mother who was a slave in Egypt, who said no to the Pharaoh when he was going to drown her baby boy. She simply said no. You know what she did? She threw the switch and threw her courage, set her family and salvation history on a whole new journey. This week, we probe the fascinating story of a man named Mordecai. The book of Esther is really pretty unique in the Bible. The hero is a young woman. It is set in southwestern Iran, not in Israel. And among other things, it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't specifically mention God. The story takes us to the opulence of the Persian capital of Susa, 483 BC. This is a story that is filled with sex and violence. It's a story that addresses racism and gender roles, resisting evil, systemic oppression, regular oppression, attempted genocide, intrigue, biting irony, and a huge reversal of fortune at the end. It honestly, of all the Bible stories, seems like something ripped out of today's headlines. So let's look at the cast, let's follow the storyline, and see what God might teach us from the vantage point of Mordecai, who's both the glue that holds this story together and the least colorful person in the whole narrative. First of all, let's look at the cast. First of all, King Xerxes. He succeeded Darius the First as the Persian king in 486 BC. He's 36 years old. He has a 21-year reign, but he's early in it. The big idea for Xerxes is that Xerxes has been unable to move the needle forward. In a time when superpowers, Mesopotamian superpowers, were supposed to conquest and grow the kingdom, Darius simply was not getting that done. He needed to prove his greatness. He's not off to a great start. He's been a king for about 3 years. His queen is Queen Vashti. She is beautiful. She is the kidnapped daughter of Belshazzar of Babylonia. She was given to Xerxes by Darius, but she has a mind of her own. The next character is Esther. In her Jewish name is Hadassah. She's an orphan. She too is beautiful. She is a Benjaminite. And when all of the Jewish kinsmen returned to Israel from exile, she didn't go. She didn't go. She would have seen herself very much as Persian. Then we have Mordecai. He too is Jewish. He's a resident of Susa. He raised Esther. He's a mid-level government official. He too did not return with the exiles. So whatever he sees his future as, it's in Persia, not back in Israel. And then finally we have Haman, who's an Agagite. The Agagites were a people wiped out by King David. So Haman is very much an anti-Semite. He's noble, he's ruthless, he's cunning, and he's an influential advisor to Xerxes. That's the cast. Let's look at the scenes. Scene one, the man crises. Xerxes is trying to impress everyone in his kingdom with his greatness. And since he hasn't really done anything great, he's just trying to impress people. So he holds this six-month feast for all of his princes and his nobles and his generals and his governors. It is a six-month feast, all right? At the end of the 6 month, he holds a seven-day feast for his servants, his local government officials, kind of for the next tier down. They have a seven-day feast. Everybody's drinking a lot. Xerxes kind of gets full of himself, and he summons Queen Vashti. And he wants to show everybody how beautiful she is. Now, there are all kinds of varying accounts as to what he wanted her to do. Some people think it was something very modest. Other people think it was something more immodest. Doesn't matter. He wanted to put her on display in front of all of his drunken minor dignitaries to show how beautiful she was. And she refused. She said, no, not going to do it, not going to happen. Now, all of a sudden, we get what I'm calling a man crisis. The most powerful man in his world has summoned his queen, and she said no. Darius is furious. His cabinet is in disarray. They've got a problem on their hands. So he holds a council of all of his cabinet. He says, what should I do? Well, the first thing they did is they demote Vashti. Now, she would have just gone back to the harem. In those days, you would have had a main queen, and then you had a lot of young women who would certainly be aging throughout the tenure of the king who are set aside in the harem. The first thing I need you to know is being in a harem would have been a horrible life. Most of these women are forgotten. They are not going to get to have families of their own. They're not going to get to have husbands. They probably have a lot of luxuries. They're guarded by eunuchs, but they live a pretty rough life in every way. That brings us to scene two, the reality show. The advisors of Xerxes said, let's have a contest. Let's find the most beautiful virgins in all of Persia. We'll bring them to you. We'll make them all beautiful. And then you can just sort of decide which one gets to be your queen. It's actually more tawdry than that, but that's the basic idea. So we kind of have this reality show kind of thing going, as twisted as it all seems. And so all of these women are picked out to go before the king. Now the problem with this, as if there weren't plenty of problems, the problem with this is that whoever goes in with the king who's not chosen is going to go to the harem. These beautiful young girls are never going to get regular lives. They're not going to have families. They're not going to have husbands. This is a really bad deal for the girls. But being as you're in it, I guess you would want to win it. So all of a sudden, Esther wins. Esther wins. But nobody knows she's Jewish. Oh, when the Jews went back from the exile, she didn't go. Obviously, a whole lot of other people didn't go either. But she is not identifying as Jewish. People just think she's Persian. Esther wins. And then as Xerxes is prone to do, he soon gets tired of Esther. She's the main queen, but she's in the harem with all the others. And he doesn't really call for her. She kind of wins and then goes away, like a reality TV star today. Mordecai is her cousin or uncle, however you want to look at the interpretation, but he raised her. Mordecai's kind of a mid-level kind of government official. He keeps his ears open, he circulates, and all of a sudden he intercepts an assassination plot. He finds out these two people are going to try to assassinate Xerxes. He calls for Esther. He gives her the information. She tells the king. They do an investigation. Sure enough, this is an assassination plot. and the assassins are executed. It is all officially noted. Esther gives Mordecai the credit. His name goes down in the history books as somebody that did something great, but then Mordecai too is forgotten by Xerxes. It's kind of a story of everybody who's ever done something good and loyal and then feels like you were just given a certificate and forgotten. That brings us to scene three, the emergence of evil. Haman is another official, this anti-Semite. All of a sudden, he is named prime minister. He's number two in all of Persia. Now, part of being prime minister is that there's a lot of ego candy for you to eat. And part of it is when Haman goes out, people are supposed to bow down to him. I mean, that's got to be feel pretty good if you're on a power trip, right? The problem is Mordecai isn't going to bow down to him. Jews aren't going to bow down to people. It's a problem in exile throughout the whole thing. But the Jews just aren't going to bow to anybody. So this gets under Haman's skin. He's already an anti-Semite, and he begins to obsess on his hatred for Mordecai. Now, King Xerxes has just thrown this huge feast, and he's really drained the treasury of Persia. He's not winning battles, so it's not like you're getting replenishing. You can't really just tax everybody forever. So he is in need of some money to resupply things after this six-month feast. And so Haman, who hates Jews, who especially hates Mordecai, has an idea. He says, King, there's this group of people still left in the country. You know, a lot of them left and went back to Israel, but a few of them are still left. Actually, a lot of them are still left. They don't abide by our customs. They're never going to fit in here. And they don't respect you, and they don't respect me. I've got an idea, if you will let me take care of this, that we can get rid of these people, and I'll fill your treasury back up. Xerxes didn't ask for a lot of details. He said, okay, make it so. So all of a sudden, there is a plot to destroy the Jews in Persia. This is evil on a massive scale. This is Hitlerian kind of evil. It is genocide, where people are going to be killed and then their assets are going to be stolen by those who murdered them. There's going to be confiscation. It's going to resupply the government coffins. This is going to be a really bloody, horrible thing in which the Jewish population of Persia are going to be murdered and plundered. Scene four, the twist in the plot. Mordecai, remember, Mordecai's well-connected. He listens. He discovers this plot. He uncovers it. He mourns because there's a crisis in the making. He has to do something, but he has limited influence. He's not the prime minister. He's a mid-level government official. He's a civil servant. He doesn't have big-time torque. In fact, he doesn't even have enough torque to cause a problem. He just knows something that's going to happen that no one thinks is a problem. So he reaches out to Esther. After all, she's the queen. He says, Esther, this is what's going to happen to your people. And I'm going to ask you to put yourself in a life or death situation and approach the king and tell him that you indeed are Jewish and that this is a death warrant for you, that they are trying to kill you. Haman is trying to kill you. And if they kill all the Jews, they will try to kill you as well. And then he says, I know this is a bad deal for you, but perhaps for such a time as this, God made you queen. For such a time as this. To make a long story shorter, Esther steps up. She leverages the blessing. She goes before the king. He understands, and he's sympathetic to Esther's side, which leads us to the final scene, a reversal of fortune. Now, Haman hates Mordecai so much that he was so excited about this day when everybody got to attack the Jews and murder them and steal all their stuff, that he built a gallows, especially for Mordecai. There is a gallows going up His best day of his life is when he sees Mordecai hanging from it. But all of a sudden, in this mess of events, the king has a dream. And the king remembers that somebody tried to assassinate him, and that somebody tipped the king off. And he thought, I don't think we rewarded that person at all. And so the king calls in Haman, and he says, what should a king do for somebody that's really, really pleased him? Haman thinks he's talking about him. So he tells him all this great stuff. Well, the king does it for Mordecai, Haman's mortal enemy. Mordecai is honored. And then Esther, who has the heart of the king once again, the king says, ask anything of me. And she said, okay. You can't rescind the order according to Persian law. People are going to try to murder my kinsmen and steal their property. I want you to put out another edict that says the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And anyone who attacks the Jews that the Jews kill, the Jews get their property. And I don't just want you to do it one day. I want it to go right into day two. So all of a sudden, through a series of events, Haman finds himself at the very wrath of the king. Haman is actually hanged on his own gallows that he built for Mordecai. Mordecai actually becomes the new prime minister. He gets Haman's job. The Jews are allowed to defend themselves, and instead of being eradicated and plundered, the Jews gain property and influence by defeating the people who try to defeat them. It's an incredible story. It's all about a Jewish holiday called Purim. But this gets us to our Be a Game Changer, big ideas. I've got seven of them for you. Number one, some things are unacceptable. You see, when Mordecai found out what was going on, it wasn't okay to do nothing. Sometimes it's not okay to do nothing. Someone has to do something. Number two, God pings leaders during critical times. Now, there is macro critical times and micro critical times. Macro is when all the Jews in Persia, their life was in danger. But a micro critical time may be a blow up in your own family. It may be something happening that's right in your household, but that needs a leader just as much as the macro issues. Number three, leadership is simply risky. It's simply risky. Any situation that requires leadership means that there are no guarantees. The only time it's easy to be a leader is when leadership is not needed. If you need a leader, it's going to be risky. Number four, we can all lead in some way. Ehud led from the top down. Jochebed led from the bottom up. Mordecai is finding a way to lead from the middle. Every single one of us can lead in some way. Number five, justice eventually arrives. It's what we pray in the Lord's Prayer when we say, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Justice eventually arrives. What's wrong eventually gets set right. Number six, good is eventually rewarded. I mean, Mordecai was loyal. Mordecai was faithful. And it really was starting to look like that no good deed was going to go unpunished. It looked like he was going to hang from Haman's gallows. And all he had been was loyal and faithful and true. But you know what? Good was eventually rewarded. The king had a dream and wanted to make something that was wrong right. I love Galatians 6:9. In due time we shall reap if we do not let our hearts grow weary. So don't lose heart in doing good, because in due time we shall reap. Let me paraphrase. Do the right thing the right way. You'll get the right results in the right time. Mordecai gets the right results in a strategic time. He has found favor with the king in a highly critical moment. Good is eventually rewarded. Number seven, salvation history marches on. You see, no matter what your story is, I need to tell you, there is a bigger story. There's a larger narrative. There's always more going on than what you think is going on. You may have a crisis in your family now, and you think this is just our family crisis. Do you know that crisis could affect your family for generations? My friends, there's always more going on. Salvation history marches on. When you decide you're going to be the arrow and not the target, when you decide you're going to throw the switch, when you make those decisions, you are a game changer, not in your present situation alone, but you change the game moving forward. Mordecai was a mid-level civil servant who served his king faithfully and in absolute obscurity. He was the kind of person who spent his career sitting and watching lesser people be promoted time after time. He really only had two things with which he could lead. Number one, a track record of loyalty and faithfulness to his niece and to his king. Other than that, all he had was just a minor amount of influence in some way. And yet, rather than conclude that he didn't have enough power to be a game changer, he attempted to inspire those who did. He attempted to inspire those who did, to let them know what was truly going on, to encourage them to take the risk because they had a chance of success that he simply did not have. Or you or someone you know in a tough situation right now. Perhaps this is your for such a time as this moment. Maybe right now God's pinging you and you are the leader God is calling to your situation. In difficult times, God will often use what we have for his glory if everything we have belongs to him. You see, my friends, if you offer to God everything he gave you and say, Lord, I may not have as many gifts and skills as I wish I had or somebody else may have, but Lord, everything you've given me, I freely give to you. And even if what you have to give to God is loyalty and faithfulness, that's what Mordecai had to give. Even if that's what you have to give to God and nothing else, God can use that. God can multiply that. You see, God can multiply what you give him. You give God a little something, he can turn it into a lot of something. You give God nothing, there's no way to multiply nothing. You know, for me, it's a simple four-step process. Number one, we got to stay in right relationship with God. Number two, we have to assess our gifts. We need to know what our gifts are. You know, Ehud had a military special forces skill set. Jochebed had the gift of unbelievable courage. Mordecai ends up being pretty well connected. We got to know what our gifts are. Number three, we have to listen for the God ping. When God says, boom, it is your time. Boom, it is time for you to act in some way. It may be as simple as making a flood bucket. It may be as challenging as stepping into leadership with the new going deeper campuses that we're going to do at your campus. It may be something small. It may be something big. But when God pings, you got to step into it. And then number four, you have to be willing to apply your gifts to the situation. You got to be willing to apply your gifts to the situation. It's not about what you can't do. It's about finding what you can do. And a lot of times, because we can't do everything, we don't do anything. But if a lot of people do something, then everything gets done. Listen for the ping. Give God your gifts and apply them to the situation. I'd like to close by simply giving you an opportunity to re-offer yourself with God. I know that close to 400 of you took the Be a Game Changer Challenge. And this might be a good time as we close this service just to focus our hearts on our commitment. I want to encourage you to continue to pray for our church. Pray for me. Pray for us as we launch these new Going Deeper services. Pray for us as we move boldly into our future. Number two, I just want to encourage you to make a priority of attending. One of the great things at your campus is going to be, there's going to be two worship service options. If you can't make it on Sunday, we're going to have Wednesday available to you. And so I just want to encourage you to make attending a priority. Number three, tithe. Give to God. Give God something to bless. Everything we're doing takes resources, both financial and human, to make happen. Be a part of moving that forward. Number four, get involved with a connect group or a small group. If you can't do that, just find someone else that you know that you guys can be a group. Talk about the sermons. You don't always have to do things programmatically. Find somebody that you go to church with and then talk about what you've experienced. Talk about how it may apply. Get in a group, more than one, in some way. Number five, find a place to serve. Find a place to serve. There are a lot of opportunities. These new Tuesday nights are going to be giving us new opportunities to serve. We always need servants who are faithful and dependable and willing to use what they've got. And number six, invite someone to church every single week. Invite someone to church every single week. Did you know if every person watching this, every adult or student watching this, invited one new person to church every week for 52 weeks, and only one of those 52 invitations resulted in somebody actually plugging into the church, our church would double in a year. Your campus would double in 1 year. If every person would just invite one person to church every week, and one out of 52 people we invited actually got plugged in. It's amazing what God can do. You see, a lot of times we think, God, I would give you a lot, but I don't feel like I have a lot. And God's saying, I gave you what you have. Give it to me and I will multiply it. Give what you have to God. Be a game changer. Be a catalyst in your own situation. And when leadership is needed, think to yourself, perhaps, just perhaps, for such a time as this, I was born. Would you pray with me? Great and mighty God, thank you for the game changers that are within the sound of my voice. I pray, dear God, as they drill into their own hearts, as they align themselves with you, as they truly assess their gifts, as they listen and are responsive to your ping, and as they are willing to step up for you, I pray that you would bless them and make them a blessing to many. Dear God, give us the strength. Give us the strength to be the arrow and not the target, to throw the switch and to look for such a time as this moment. And we pray it in Jesus' strong name.